Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. The number of foster kids in LA County is up, but the number of homes are down. What to do to fill the need? How about going to church? Plus, why would anyone challenge a U.S. senator who's held a seat for 26 years?
I made a decision that I would lead the resistance for California because what I identified was that Donald Trump was a clear and present danger.
Kevin DeLeon will tell you why you should vote for him over Dianne Feinstein. It's all ahead on Take Two.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez, and I don't know about you, but this Santa Ana dry air is really, really getting to me, to all of us who drink lots of water. Los Angeles, also a little lip balm might to help out. At least those winds are expected to mellow out today. All right, in other news, firefighters who assisted during the Aliso Canyon gas leak in 2015 have filed a lawsuit alleging it made them sick. We'll talk about their case a little later in the show. First, though, score one for the public. The Supreme Court Monday refused to hear a California court decision that found three major paint companies liable for lead contamination in thousands of homes built before 1951. It's a big blow to the paint companies, Sherwin-Williams, Conagra, and NL Industries, who argued they should not be held solely responsible, and it could pave the way for similar lawsuits filed in the state. Sean Hecht is an environmental law professor at UCLA. Sean, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
All right. This is a legal battle that goes back several years. So let's get a little background for those who have not been following it. What's the basis for the original lawsuit?
Sure. So lead paint causes all kinds of different problems for people who live in the housing that that has lead paint in it. It creates neurological problems for kids. It's been responsible for tremendous public health harm. And local governments throughout California filed this lawsuit almost two decades ago to try to get former manufacturers of lead paint to pay for the cost of abating that lead paint on the theory that these companies knew what the risks were of the paint. They hid those risks from the public and marketed the paint as safe. And courts agreed ultimately with the argument after many, many years of legal wrangling.
And what did the California Appeals Court ask the paint companies to do?
So the California Court of Appeal upheld a trial court decision holding that the paint companies had to pay money into an abatement fund to allow these local governments to clean up the lead. And at the same time, it ruled that only housing built before 1951 was housing that the paint companies were responsible for because they stopped their deceptive marketing after that time. So so it's hundreds of millions of dollars that they're going to have to pay into this fund that will then enable local governments to clean up the lead.
And the bill, $400 million, right? That's the ticket.
That's the estimate right now. It's not clear precisely what the number will be. There's still going to be an evidentiary hearing, I believe, on the precise number, but it's going to be in that $400 to $500 million range, people believe.
So will they really have to go and get all these homes and strip the paint, fix everything, and maybe paint it again?
Well, it'll be up to the local governments exactly what they do to abate the paint hazards. There's a bunch of different strategies. They don't all involve stripping the paint. Some of them involve encapsulating the paint because it's only if the paint's in poor condition that it will pose a hazard. But yes, they will have to identify the housing that's affected and address the hazards. I mean, much of the housing has already been identified, but I'm sure there's a lot of work that'll be left to do, and that'll be part of what the fund is used for.
We're talking to Sean Hecht, environmental law professor at UCLA. Now, Sean, the business community was pretty alarmed by this decision. What other similar lawsuits might gain traction in California because of what just happened?
Yes, some businesses are concerned because of the wide scope of liability, and there are lawsuits that local governments have filed against oil companies for the oil companies' contribution to climate change on a kind of similar legal theory, the idea being that these oil companies hid the risks of their products and deceptively marketed them and produced all this oil that ended up harming these local governments that now have to pay to adapt adapt to the consequences. We also see the potential for this legal theory to be used against, for example, opioid manufacturers, any manufacturer who can credibly be accused of having known about and hidden the risks of their products and marketed them to the public and prevented or provided a disincentive for safer alternatives to go into the market might be at risk.
Sean, what do you think? You're the law professor in the room. Do you think these lawsuits could have any legs?
Well, certainly, the lead paint one did, and the oil companies' lawsuits, local government lawsuits against oil companies are progressing through the courts, and the arguments are quite similar. It's hard to know. I mean, in any particular case, it really depends on the proof of the deceptive practices and the link between those deceptive practices and the ultimate harms. I think that the local government cases against the oil companies are quite plausible. I know less about the facts in the opioid cases other than what I read in the newspapers. Mm. But yes, I could imagine this. I mean, I don't think it's going to be widespread around a lot of different industries. It's only industries that have this particular kind of, a factual situation that might be a risk.
Sean Hecht is the co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. Sean, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Turning now to the midterms, it's countdown time for the November 6th election. By now, you've probably gotten your vote by mail ballots and your voter information guides from the state and from your county. Now, if you haven't opened them yet and started to get ready, we are here to help with the latest installment of our Human Voter Guide.
Welcome, human.
The Human Voter Guide.
The Human Voter Guide.
Welcome to the Human Voter Guide.
A real person to help with your election questions.
So you don't have to search for answers.
Here to help you navigate the upcoming election is KPCC's political correspondent, Mary Plummer, a.k.a. The Human Voter Guide. Hello, Mary.
Hi, A.
All right, so let's start by talking about some robocalls that have been going out in L.A. County and confusing some voters. What is up with the robocalls? Should we be worried that they're taking over finally?
Yeah, I don't know if the robots are taking over, but you might have gotten one of these calls. There was a robocall going out saying that there was an error in one of the ballot titles. This was regarding Prop 6, which I know you've talked about a lot. That's the heated battle over whether the gas tax should be repealed. LA County election officials have come out with a release letting people know this did not come from them, and there is no error in the title. In fact, ballot titles are prepared by the state attorney general with no alterations by local election officials. So the takeaway here is to be extra cautious. I know this confused a lot of folks. This robocall was sponsored by a campaign. As with those mailers that you're getting in your mailbox, be careful. Do your own research.
All right. Speaking of mailers, in the past, we've talked about how to know if what you're looking at is coming from a candidate. But what about something called slate mailers? What are slate mailers?
So slate mailers will arrive in your mailbox, and they'll appear to be a list of endorsements from an organization. But do be careful when you look at these, because they're often paid advertisements for candidates. We talked to Dorian Cal about this. He is the director of civic engagement research at the nonprofit Naleo Educational Fund. Here's what he said.
If you're getting a mailer from somebody and you're thinking that the nonprofit or whichever organization is actually endorsing this person, but in reality, they're getting money to be able to put them on this newsletter sort of format mailer, if you will. So that's something that, most voters wouldn't know necessarily.
And these slate mailers are getting increasingly popular, so you might be getting a lot of these. The biggest tip here is to follow the money. Here's how to do that. Every slate mailer you get has a printed notice to voters somewhere in the packet saying who it was prepared by, so definitely look for that. Also, this is a really interesting tip. Any candidate or ballot measure that paid more than $100 to be included in the slate mailer must be designated by an asterisk. So look for that asterisk. That'll be your clue to know that money was involved in the endorsement.
And some of these slate mailers have some pretty crazy names, at least the organizations like Citizens for Good Government or something very vague like that.
Right.
Yeah. All right, now on to some vote-by-mail questions. People have been asking how to fill in their ballots. Is it okay to mark your ballot with a pencil?
No pencils.
No pencils. Oh my gosh, all right.
No pencils. This is a commonly asked question we've been getting, and the answer is no pencils. We've checked with election officials in Orange County and LA County. Both tell us you'll want to use a pen that has blue or black ink. The LA County vote-by-mail ballots have a symbol that actually kind of looks like a pencil, so do not let that confuse you. You really want to use pen, blue or black ink.
And LA County ballots are different for this election, right?
They are. Vote-by-mail ballots in LA County have been totally changed for this election. They look very different. In the past, we had those Scantron-like ballots. Those are no longer, so they've switched over to a new system. If you have any questions at all about that, do let us know. You can reach us via email. The email is humanvoterguide@kpcc.org. We've been hearing feedback from folks, and it's really helpful. We'll try to answer more questions as we go along, getting closer to the election.
Okay, another vote-by-mail ballot question. This one comes from LA County resident Barbara Benefiel. She lives in Windsor Hills, but her grandson goes to school out of state, and she had a question about that.
My grandson is going to school at NYU, and his mail-in ballot is coming to his parents here in California because he's registered in California. And the question is, can they get his decisions, fill out the ballot, sign it, and mail it in, or does the ballot need to go to him in New York for him to complete and sign himself and mail in from there?
Ooh, I can't wait to hear the answer to this one, Mary.
We did some research on this. A lot of kids are out of state for school. College students are out of state. So in this case, it's best to mail the ballot to the out-of-state voter. They will need to sign the envelopes themselves and then mail it in. That's the key. Everyone has to sign their own vote-by-mail ballot. Another option, if you know you're going to be in the same place for college for all 4 years, you might want to change your permanent vote-by-mail address. And you would do that by going to registertovote.ca.gov and re-registering and selecting a permanent vote by mail as your option. Just as a reminder, the online voter registration deadline is October 22nd. That is on Monday.
All right. One last vote by mail question before you go. LA County voters get a ballot secrecy sleeve. Do voters have to use it? And what happens if you seal up your envelope and mail it without including that?
If you do that, don't worry, don't panic. That secrecy sleeve is totally optional. It's really just for your privacy if you want to use it. So you don't have to. You can still mail it off without it.
I love the title, Ballot Secrecy Sleeve.
I like it too.
I know. Thanks, Mary Plummer. That's KPCC's political correspondent, Mary Plummer. Remember, you can ask us anything about voting. The email is humanvoterguide@kpcc.org. You can also find Mary on Twitter. Her handle is @MaryPlummer. And we'll be back next week with more answers to your voting questions. All right, so you know there are a lot of things to vote on 3 weeks from today. Here at Take Two, we've loaded you up with a lot of useful information on ballot measures, judges, the governor's race. We've also dug into local congressional battles, but today it's all about one of California's U.S. Senate seats. Coming up next, Kevin DeLeon will tell you why what some describe as his aggressively progressive style is now a better fit for California over Dianne Feinstein. That's ahead in 60 seconds.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now at Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. State Senator Kevin DeLeon is no stranger to political friction. He spent 12 years in the legislature authoring or signing on to some of his most controversial bills in the age of President Trump. Sanctuary state laws, a clean energy bill. Now, though, DeLeon faces the biggest fight of his career. He's going after the Senate seat of fellow Democrat Dianne Feinstein. And by most metrics, DeLeon is the underdog. The latest polls show Feinstein leading by 11 points. In this Democrat versus Democrat race, it can be hard to draw contrast between the two candidates. So at the start of our conversation last week, DeLeon said the biggest difference between he and Senator Feinstein comes down to one word, values.
These are very dangerous times in our nation's history. We have a president who makes Richard Nixon look like a choir boy. And I think that we need to speak truth to power. And when I heard that the senior center made a comment at the San Francisco Commonwealth Club, which was, perhaps if we're patient enough, that this president, Donald J. Trump, could become a good president in the future, that hit me like a 2x4. I can tell you this, as the youngest child of a single immigrant mother with a third grade education, my values have always been about providing opportunities for those who have very little opportunities to succeed in our state and our nation.
So what are yours and hers?
I will say this, that I believe strongly in moving values that are manifested in policies that improve the human condition for all individuals.
What specifically, though?
100% clean energy. Sanctuary state. I'm the author of Sanctuary State.
So you're saying that Dianne Feinstein wouldn't be supportive of that?
Well, if she floated the idea back in 2015 of actually moving a piece of legislation in the U.S. Senate to outlaw the establishment of sanctuary cities, I actually moved forward the establishment of a sanctuary state. That's a huge contrast between our values.
But so, what did you expect her to say, though, when President Trump was elected?
What I expected to say is that she would do everything within her power to protect the people of California. Just like what I made a decision when President Trump was elected to become president through the Electoral College system, an antiquated Hamiltonian system that we currently have today, is that I made a decision, controversial it may be, that I would lead the resistance for California. Because what I identified was that Donald Trump was a clear and present danger.
Who's going to be here for 4 years, though. When she made those comments, though, he was going to be there for 4 more years. So, yes, if that's what you believe, but you know you have to work with him, too.
I think what have we produced so far for the benefit of California? To date, arguably by any objective measure, there has been nothing brought to California. In fact, undermining our climate change policies, our fuel efficiency policies, as well as detaining Dreamers, DACA students. In my own district, in Highland Park, the story of Romolo, who was dropping off his daughter in the morning, just a block away from the middle school that she attends, and he was detained by ICE agents. Luckily, I was able to secure his freedom, and he's out, a loving father. That's what's happened since Donald Trump has been elected president of the United States. So any concrete measurement that brings value to our state of California has not come to fruition. So I think that's why Californians want a voice that will fight for them on the issues that they care deeply about.
Now, all this leads me to this next question. Politics in Washington, you know this, very, very polarized right now. Centrist lawmakers are far and few. What are some issues that you think you could maybe compromise with Republicans?
You can find common ground with Republicans.
Like, what would be one thing?
I can tell you this right now. The issue of climate change. Believe it or not, in California, we have created 500,000 jobs in the clean energy space. That is 10 times more jobs in California in the clean energy space than there are coal mining jobs in all of America. So if that takes flying the red, white, and blue Old Glory on a wind turbine or a solar array, so be it, if you need to make it patriotic. But climate change is going to impact Democrats and Republicans alike. I would work with my Republican colleagues in the U.S. Senate and say, hey, we can actually delink and decouple carbon from GDP, which means we can actually reduce our greenhouse gases and grow our economy.
A coal-burning state. How do you convince a coal-burning state to do that?
Well, the problem is not with the coal miners. The coal miners are doing what they know and what they do best. The problem is with the politicians in those respective regions at the federal, state, and local level that have not read the tea leaves that coal consumption is decreasing domestically and internationally. So the market is not going to be there in the near future. But what I'd like to do is depoliticize this issue and demonstrate to my Republican colleagues and friends that you can actually grow an economy and put hardworking voters, constituents, Republicans, and Democrats to work.
Do you think you'd be able to take the California clean energy model to other states?
Oh, there's no question about it.
You make it sound like it'd be easy.
No, it wouldn't be easy by no stretch of imagination, but you got to try. Because if you subscribe to the status quo of Washington, D.C., with everything's, well, you can't do this, you can't do that, everything's no, 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 all the naysayers. If you don't try, you're not going to be able to get anywhere. And that's why this race is so critical, because California is a restless, innovative, disruptive state. So, that being said, working with our Republican colleagues and say, hey, there's a red state called Wyoming that has the best wind in the United States of America. That's a Republican state. And if they're going to export that wind through our transmission lines, through our grid to California, exporting clean electrons, and we can export ourselves clean electrons to other states, growing our economy in a regional way, in a national way, that's the future.
Talking to California State Senator Kevin DeLeon. All right, switching gears now. A lot of controversy around President Trump's Supreme Court pick. Senator Feinstein faced presidential criticism for not releasing a letter detailing the assault allegations against Brett Kavanaugh. You criticized Senator Feinstein as well. Then she revealed that the accuser asked for confidentiality. Do you still stand by your criticism of Senator Feinstein?
Let me say what I would have done differently. What I would have done differently is I would never have enabled a vote to begin with of Brett Kavanaugh to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals.
When it comes to the letter, though, what would you have done differently if that letter had arrived on your desk as a U.S. senator?
If it arrived on my desk as a U.S. senator, first and foremost, what is most paramount is the confidentiality and the privacy of Dr. Christine Ford, to make sure that she's safe, and if she didn't want the letters to be released or her identity specifically, I would respect that.
That's what Senator Feinstein did, and you called it a leadership failure.
Because she never engaged with her colleagues in the U.S. Senate, specifically her Democratic colleagues, who were quite surprised at the existence of the letter itself. Give me an opportunity to roll back this a little bit, because Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court because Senator Feinstein enabled a vote in 2006 for him to be voted on to the D.C. Court of Appeals. Be mindful about one thing. Chuck Schumer, Hillary Clinton, the late Ted Kennedy, as well as John Kerry, Barbara Boxer, they all voted no. But the senior senator from California voted aye, knowing already ahead of time his views on women, on workers' rights, on civil rights, on voting rights, on our environmental laws.
How could you be expected to know in 2006 what would happen in 2018?
Hey, when you have almost the entire Democratic caucus of the U.S. Senate voting no, I think that's a good sign. And if you know the views specifically already as legal secretary from then White House George W. Bush, that's a pretty good sign.
So, but in the confirmation hearings, how would you have handled that differently?
Well, in the confirmation hearings, I would never have apologized to Brett Kavanaugh for women who were protesting and exercising their First Amendment to the Constitution. I would never have apologized. You witnessed Kamala Harris as well as Mr. Blumenthal from Connecticut and Cory Booker from New Jersey be much more assertive in making motions for an adjournment.
Kamala Harris walked out of the room at one point.
She did.
And Senator Feinstein stayed in the room.
The end result was the same.
But wasn't that a result that we were going to get to?
No, because I think Senator Kamala Harris as well as Cory Booker and the other Democratic members of the Judiciary Committee try to delay the hearings by making motions for adjournment. And unfortunately, sadly, the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee did not follow suit and continue to read her statement, therefore nullifying the motion that was being made by her Democratic colleagues. So there was clearly no programming or coordinating between the senior ranking member of the Judiciary Committee along with her colleagues, junior senators on the Judiciary Committee.
I want to stay on this topic for a minute. Activists and at least one lawmaker have criticized the way you handled the Me Too movement last year when you led the state Senate. There were a lot of accusations going around at the time against lawmakers, lobbyists, staffers. Three lawmakers resigned. Some say you repeatedly blocked a whistleblower protection bill that could have helped people. In retrospect, would you have done anything differently?
Let me say this, is that no individual should ever be sexually harassed, especially when all they're trying to do is their job. I'm very proud of the work that we did working with the female senators of the Democratic caucus in the California State Senate and moving and overhauling all of our internal policies, which today now have outsourced all investigations, which are no longer part of the California Senate, but now are part of an independent law firm that's free from any type of political influence. Let me go to the point that you're making with the member of the assembly who's criticized me. A Republican who voted no on yes means yes, sexual assaults. A Republican who voted no on equal pay for women doing equal work.
Now, I hear what you're saying, but still, would you have done things differently back then?
Give me an example.
The bill got held up in the Senate Appropriations Committee. You chaired it. Nothing happened in that year you chaired it, so why not?
I think the bill was held. There was no sexual provisions in the measure itself. And then we are the ones who put the sexual harassment provisions in the bill itself. Then we moved the bill forward. There was no Me Too movement at that time.
But did there have to be one, though?
No, but I think that by overhauling our internal process, we have a model that should be duplicated in the rest of the country.
Okay, changing direction for a second. It was announced that you and Senator Feinstein will finally debate.
A conversation.
Conversation.
Not a debate.
Right.
A debate is debate rules and style.
This is different. So I'm wondering, does that upset you that it's in this style? Does that bother you?
Well, you know, we respectfully and publicly requested three debates in Northern California and Southern California and Central California. I know that the LA Times, ABC, NBC, La Opinion, and Univision have all asked for official debates. They have been accepted by us. They have been turned down by Senator Feinstein. I want to be very clear. It is not a debate, nor is it debate style. It is more a conversation, and that was a more reflection of what the Feinstein camp wanted and what they negotiated specifically. If they didn't secure the conversation, although they wanted to call it a debate, they were going to walk away and say there's nothing at all whatsoever. In fact, they said, if you want that, we'll just give you just radio specifically.
Because here's the thing. I mean, mail-in ballots, people have been sending them in. People will have already maybe made a choice before they even get to hear this conversation.
Well, we've asked for many, many months ago for debates, but we kind of sensed and we felt that they would, if there was going to be any debate, in this case a conversation, that they would drag it in as deep as possible in October.
Now, we'll mention that we have given Senator Feinstein the same invitation to come on the program that we've given you. We've yet to solidify an interview. So let's end on this. It's the night of the election. There's an upset win. Despite the polls and the massive war chest, you beat Senator Dianne Feinstein. What's the first thing you do in D.C.?
The first thing I do is, it's not necessarily the first thing I do, but the issues that I care deeply about is health care for all, climate change, and immigration reform. You got to have a voice, even if you're in the minority. You can still elevate these issues. When difficult times face us, that reveals your character and who you are as an individual, Democrat or Republican. It doesn't make a difference. And I think that Americans and Californians can see that. Folks will judge me and others will spin me. And yes, you're right. I have been involved in very controversial measures that have not been easy. But I think that's what people want. They want a fighter, not someone who's going to be mealy-mouthed and just sort of go with the status quo. If I have an opportunity to be the next U.S. senator representing the great state of California, I'm just going to roll up my sleeves. I'm going to work close with Governor Gavin Newsom, my colleagues in the state legislature, wonderful colleagues. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom will win, will be our next governor. Work together to leverage our power to protect California and move policies that are not just good for California, but they're good for the rest of the nation.
That's State Senator Kevin DeLeon. He's running for senator. He's challenging fellow Democrat Dianne Feinstein. Senator, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
KPCC has extended several invitations to the Feinstein campaign. No word yet on whether we'll be hearing from her. So, Senator Feinstein, if you're out there listening, we are waiting for you. And State Senator Kevin DeLeon will share a stage with Senator Dianne Feinstein in their first and only public discussion tomorrow at noon. You can sign up for the live stream. There's a link on our website at take2.org. All right, the number of foster kids in LA County has been climbing the last few years. One of the problems is that the number of homes to house the kids is down by a lot. Well, there's an event happening in Inglewood that's aiming to find and convince more people to become foster parents. And the key to it all involves going to church. Find out how when Take Two continues. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm E. Martinez. The number of LA County foster care homes has dropped 32% in the last decade, but the number of kids in the system who need those homes has gone up. That's according to the Department of Child and Family Services. So the DCFS and other county officials are tapping the faith community in LA for help. That's the topic of a town hall event in Inglewood tonight. It's hosted by the Chronicle of Social Change, a news site focused on vulnerable youth and families. Daniel Heimpel is the publisher.
Thanks for having me, eh?
All right. The Chronicle of Social Change has done some reporting on the national foster housing crisis, which inspired your upcoming event. Can you tell us about some of the major findings?
Yeah. So when you look nationally, I think one thing that really sticks out is if it weren't for relative caregivers, the foster care system across the United States would be in serious crisis. Wow. We've seen a loss in overall foster homes in 15 states where they've lost actual capacity to care for kids. And they're increasingly relying on relatives to do some of this work, but oftentimes they're not paying relatives the same amount that they're paying non-relative, stranger, foster parents. So that's one thing that sticks out. Another thing sticks out is while in California and federally, everybody has decried this concept of a group home as a place to keep children where six or more kids are living at a time and really focused on family type settings. Many states across this country have seen an increase in group home utilization. California has actually dropped for the past few years, but nationally that's on the rise as well. So those are some of the things that really stick out.
When it comes to the number of foster care homes in LA that are declining, do we know why?
Well, a lot of it had to do with the decline in overall numbers of kids in care. So there was a time when the number of kids in care dropped as they lost the kids. You know, they lost the capacity. You couldn't keep a home open if you had no kids to send to that home. So during that time, it dropped. Since then, I think across the country, we've really struggled with how to recruit and retain foster families.
But the number of kids in the foster care system has gone up, right? So how do we square that with the number of foster homes going down?
Well, that's, I think, creates the urgency and the reason why we're doing this event, the reason why we looked nationally to try to understand what are the big broad trends, is that there is a need for caregivers on all levels. You have, on one side, a push away from institutional settings for understandable reasons, but that creates a strain on the family type settings. And then you have, as we've seen in LA County, you referenced the numbers, that you've seen a dip in overall foster homes. Mm. That hurts the capacity. So you turn to relatives. Okay, you turn there, but you still need non-relative caregivers. And so what LA County is trying to do is really tap into the faith-based community to ensure that they're able to recruit families and also help a foster family or even a biological family stay together by virtue of the community that church can bring.
Daniel, I understand two motions were passed last month that focus on developing faith-based programs to help foster family recruitment. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Catherine Barger had a motion which...
LA County Supervisor.
LA yeah. County Supervisor Catherine Barger had a motion which was really focused on how can that community in the 5th Supervisorial District do kind of what these South LA churches are doing, which is what are the ways that they want to step up and help in this. So not very prescriptive. It wasn't saying we're going to give you money to you churches to recruit a bunch of foster families. It was let's get a consultant to work with you to figure out what you need and go back to DCFS and figure out where you guys can help. And so trying to engender the faith community to help on all levels of foster care. Mm. In Pomona, that area. And then the other motion by Supervisor Solis was really focused on how can the faith community be helpful in reducing the disproportionate number of Black children that enter the foster care system.
In general, how easy is it to be a foster parent? Because I can imagine there's probably a lot of parents out there that would make great foster parents, but maybe they're thinking, this process is too much, I can't do it.
Yeah, I think that's been historically a big problem. You have very long wait times to become a foster parent. You got to go through background checks. You know, if you move from a different state, the background checks got to follow you to that state. You need to make sure that your house is properly stocked, that you have the amount of bedrooms necessary. So there's a lot of hoops that you have to jump through that I think turn a lot of people away. And that's why the county is really looking to new places to go. The faith-based community has been involved in this for a long time, but now the county's really stepping in, and there's a bunch of churches in South LA that are really stepping up and saying they're going to open their doors.
Based on what you said, Daniel, then tell me about the faith component, this event that you're doing.
Yeah, so LA County, I think, you know, a lot of folks have realized that there is a real crisis in the capacity of foster homes, the places for kids to stay. And out of that recognition, a bunch of big funders came together to create a collective impact group, which spun off this group of people who reached out to some South LA churches, and they worked together with those churches, asked what those churches need to braid them together. And right now there's about 6 churches that are lined up to create this faith network, mm-hmm. a network to recruit foster families. And, you know, one of the people at our event is going to be Pastor Jeremy Dixon. He is a foster dad himself at the Center of Hope. And, you know, I think he's a real example of how your faith can help you step up to do this work and how having a community around you can ensure that those children have the support they need and that the parents have the support they need.
We're talking to Daniel Heimpel, publisher of the Chronicle of Social Change. So how would this work in practice? Churches would make the announcement on Sundays, or how would it work in general to get these kids in foster homes kind of hooked up together?
Well, they're ironing out all the details now. They're coming up with a memorandum of understanding between these churches, and they're going to be actively working with the Department of Children and Family Services to identify parents that would be suitable and try to get them in the pipeline and try to get them licensed, go through all the hoops that we mentioned before, and get in there.
Why do you think churches in particular, though, the faith community, is getting their involvement is so important here?
I think a church is a place where people slow down and have a community. And I think that any family does well in community. And I think that being able to tap into other people around you who can look out for you is a pretty invaluable resource. Another thing is that, you know, you've got thousands of people in these congregations. So you have a pulpit from which you can reach to a lot of people very quickly in a very personal way.
That was Daniel Heimpel, publisher of the Chronicle for Social Change, talking about the declining number of foster care homes in Los Angeles and across the county. His organization is co-hosting an event today to discuss how the faith community can help address this problem, and it takes place this afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Center of Hope on Crenshaw. And we have more information on Take Two's website, take2.org. Okay, moving on. The Aliso Canyon gas leak was a big deal for SoCalGas and local residents back in 2015. That's when natural gas spilled into the air for months before the leak was stopped. Now, firefighters who responded to help residents after the gas leak are suing the Southern California Gas Company. The firefighters say they're suffering health problems because they were exposed to the gas, and they say the company did not warn them of the dangers. For more on the Aliso story, we've got KPCC infrastructure reporter Sharon McNair. Hello, Sharon.
Hey there.
All right, so give us a little background here. There was a gas leak in 2015 in the Aliso Canyon area. What happened?
Well, it was October 23rd, so we're coming up on the third anniversary of this thing. An old oil well that was converted to inject natural gas into an underground storage reservoir had corroded and split open. So it blew gas and other chemicals out for 4 months. It ended up putting a record amount of natural gas into the atmosphere. And while natural gas is mostly methane, it's lighter than air and goes straight up. Initially, that was the message coming from government and SoCal Gas Company, that it presented no hazard to workers or to residents. But natural gas contains a lot more things that can make you sick, things like formaldehyde and naphthalene and benzene.
So clearly, it's toxins, right? There's no disputing that it's toxins.
There's no safe level for benzene. And firefighters, along with SoCal Gas employees and their contractors, were a consistent presence in the vicinity of this ruptured well. The firefighters also lived at a fire station in this community, and they were circulating around Porter Ranch at a time when the county had pretty much evacuated the area. People were relocated to homes outside for months at a time. So this firefighter lawsuit contends that SoCalGas knew there was benzene in the gas. It says 100,000 times higher than the state standard for exposure to benzene. And eventually the county health department tested the soil around homes. They found like heavy metals of the sort you'd find in drilling muds and other chemicals that were shot down into the hole to try and plug it and stop the gas leak.
What health complaints did people have following the gas leak?
Bad headaches, dizziness, nosebleeds, skin rashes. And this lawsuit by the firefighters also contends that some now have cancer.
Oh, man. All right. SoCal Gas is already paying out a settlement over this leak. Where's that money going?
The settlement was with the County of Los Angeles and with some entities of the state of California. Overall, it was worth $118 million. About one third of that goes to a long-term health study of Porter Ranch residents, and some of the rest goes to methane capture projects to offset the very large amount of methane that this busted well put into the atmosphere.
All right, so what has the response from SoCalGas been to this new lawsuit from the firefighters and just to the leak overall?
The company sent a statement saying they haven't been served with the lawsuit yet, so they can't comment. And in general, the company's not addressed the specific lawsuit allegations anyway. In general, the company says nobody's proven that the community or others were exposed to a toxic level of benzene or those heavy metals or other chemicals. There's already nearly 50,000 plaintiffs who've sued SoCalGas, so this will probably be moved to the one judge who's going to hear them all, and we'll expect some of it to go to trial maybe next year.
And really quick, Sharon, there are some studies coming out soon.
Absolutely. A seismic study of the underground gas reservoir we expect to come out next month. Also, finally, the root cause analysis, this long study by an independent entity that's going to say, okay, here's what really went wrong. We kind of know that the gas pipe was corroded and that it split open. They call it like a fisheye split. But we should get a lot more information about what really happened.
All right, that's KPCC infrastructure reporter Cher McNary updating us on the latest allegations against SoCalGas related to the Aliso Canyon gas leak. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
All right, as you might know, the Dodgers got shut out by the Milwaukee Brewers last night. They're down in that series 2-1. But the great thing about baseball is there's always tomorrow, which is today. Game 5 is at 6 o'clock. Coming up, the unofficial Heading to the Dodgers Game playlist. Tunes for your ride to the ravine. That's ahead when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now at Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm E. Martinez. It's Tuesday, and I'm going to go ahead and get out my coin purse because I'm willing to bet you know what that means. That means it's Tuesday Reviews Day, and this week we're joined by music supervisor Morgan Rhodes. Hello, Morgan.
How are you?
Good. Now, you know what? You know what I love about this first act? It's Little Dragon's the name. It's electronic music, and I think for a lot of people, they think, well, it's electronic music. It's not real music, but I would strongly disagree with them.
Absolutely. It's real music, and it's been real music, at least in the case of Little Dragon, since 2007, and that's when I came to know them from their self-titled debut. But if you're fans of Little Dragon, then you should be really excited because your favorite Swedish multi-genre supergroup is back. They've been killing since 2007, yeah, by the way, and this is a tease of something new that will be forthcoming next month. This song is cool. It's up-tempo, thoroughly sexy, as it always is with them. And, of course, the ever-cool voice of Yukimi Nagano and company blessing us until the full EP is available.
And the ones that do it really well, like Little Dragon, someone will say, well, where are the nuances? I mean, it's not like they're playing instruments or anything like that, but they're there. They're there in the sounds that you hear.
Absolutely. And specifically to Little Dragon, the appeal of the band, at least for me, and I think fans will agree, is their ability to blend all sorts of genres and at the same time defying genre. So with the electronic sound of Little Dragon, you also get pop, yeah, you also get soul, you also get house. They can go anywhere. It's a soup of genres mixed up for our listening pleasure. And so this song in particular actually reminds me a little bit of Lisa and the Cult Jam. Mm-hmm.
There you go.
I wonder if I take you home. Yeah. Do you remember that jam?
You kidding?
Do you
of
remember
course.
That jam?
That
right?
is like
Fire.
The anthem of you and me's age group almost.
You put me out there. But yes, but yes, I concur. But it has that feeling. If you can't wait, they will be here at Dodger Stadium next month. So get your tickets.
Perfect. And what about the next act, Jerry's Paper? He's a local guy.
He is LA based. And he's got a new album called Like a Baby. And one of my favorite tracks is called Your Cocoon.
You say there's nothing else for me. That's only true if you're not free.
This guy grew up in L.A., went to New York, came back to California. Jerry Paper's not his real name, Morgan, but I love one of the things he says about using a different name is that Jerry Paper, that's that guy. I can explore things through that guy and not be me, whose his name is Lucas Nathan.
That's right. And he made a quirky or was a part of a quirky mockumentary that's called Who the Heck is Jerry Paper? I love this album. For those wanting to get into more of the sound, I've got four words for you. Be prepared to chill. It is very dream pop, chill wave, ethereal. So in layman's terms, it's like Toro y Moi meets Steely Dan while you're wearing a sweater. It really is lo-fi-esque and yacht rock. And my other favorite song from this album is one called Gray Area.
The music's really cool, Morgan. And the thing about it, too, is that Jerry Paper does not just sit there and just give you music to listen to. He also gets into, like, deep concepts that you really got to listen to the lyrics and everything about how he puts it all together. Because some will say he's out there, but if you're out there with him, I think you'll like the ride.
Absolutely. He's dealing with existential topics, very stream of consciousness. You have to join him in his thinking process. And this album is very floaty, so you absolutely have sonically the space and the vibe to go there. Again, as you mentioned, he's a hometown hero from right here in LA, and he will be here in December the 13th at the El Rey. So get into this guy. I love the new sound, and I love this album.
Stay. To come by in this big world, I guess I've got to get used to floating, bumping, changing.
All right, the next artist, Morgan. I love pop music. You know me, Morgan. Ariana Grande, Halsey, all that. But you know what? There are so many great voices out there that are not on the pop charts necessarily, and she's one of them, Amber Mark.
Well, I've got a lot to express, and I don't know which to confess, so I guess I'll start with the mess that is in my head, Well, I must.
Good things are happening to Amber Mark. This is a great year for her. Her star is rising on the strength of a very cool album that mixed bossa and soul. It's called Conexão, which means connection in Portuguese. She had a key placement on a hit TV series and an ever-growing fan base because of this remix of a song that I thought was already great, and also the album. She is one of the new stars of alternative soul music and soul music. She describes her sound as a tribal soulful mixture. I love that. This song is part of a double release, a 7-inch release vinyl for W Records. The proceeds of this release go to charity. The artist gets to choose their charity, and Amber Mark is honoring her mother by donating to The Rose, which is a breast cancer organization in honor of her late mother. But again, if you want to check out more of Amber Mark, check out the album that I mentioned and another album that she released before that, an EP, 333. You will love what you hear.
Now, we started off with a Swedish act. Now, we're going to bookend this with another Swedish act.
Absolutely. A Swedish duo called Jeremy and a song that I can't stop playing called Cold Blooded Love.
Morgan, this one has the studio right next to us just lip syncing to this song. People are pretending they're on stage, yeah.
This one is a scorcher, dance floor ready. And of course, Jeremy didn't invent the remix, P. Diddy did that. But they have lent their talents to some great, great acts, including Janet Jackson, Aluna George, and most notably, Frank Ocean. And this is their newest. I hope that it's a teaser of what's to come. I've talked about them before on Tuesday Reviews Day, but it's danceable, dance floor ready, and tested and approved, and just more of the good stuff that this production duo is capable of. Love, love, love this single.
All right, that's music supervisor Morgan Rhodes. Morgan, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
All right, that's it for Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 9. Up next, Air Talk with Larry Mantle.
Yeah, we're just looking at all the political ads on cable news right now,
They're all over the place.
And one of the candidates is with us today. We're going to talk with Katie Hill, and we talk with Katie Porter, both of them Democratic women running for Congress. We'll hear as they make their case with the voters in their respective districts. And Ken Starr with us, the former special prosecutor in the Clinton investigation.
All right, Air Talk next.